This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Anthony Greenwald, professor of psychology at the University of Washington, as well as adjunct professor of marketing and international business. Tony Greenwald's work has explored how the mind operates in social contexts, and he's a co-developer of the implicit association test. Tony Greenwald is here today to tell us about his book, Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People, co-authored with Mazarin Banaji and published in 2013. Welcome.
Hi, Diane.
Why did you write Blind Spot? What is your goal?
Well, this had to do with research that Mazarin Banaji and I have been engaged in for a good 20 years, and it's part of a revolution that's happening in psychology now, a revolution in which we are increasingly understanding the extent to which important actions that we take, our social interactions especially, are guided by things that we're not fully aware of and are done relatively unthinkingly. This revolution, which I call the implicit revolution, but that's not yet an established name for it, I'm pushing it, is something that is very definitely in full swing right now, and I expect it to be continuing for another decade or so.
What do you mean by blind spot? Would you elaborate?
Blind spot we're using as a metaphor for, you could think of it as a region of the brain, but that's not literally true. It's maybe thinking of it as a region of the mind to which we do not have direct access, but contains important knowledge that guides our behavior. This ties into what's a classical problem in psychology, even in philosophy, having to do with introspection, the ability to see what's in our own minds. And we are increasingly understanding the limits of that ability. This has been something debated for actually centuries among philosophers and for much of the last century among psychologists.
Well, your book addresses hidden biases. Would you underscore some of the hidden biases you address in your book?
The main ones we are concerned with are ones that involve the social and demographic categories that we encounter regularly and that we recognize most rapidly. So when we encounter people, particularly people we haven't met before, we can pick up in half a second, literally in half a second, a rather large amount of information. We can classify them by age, by race, by sex, very frequently by social class based on their clothing, by ethnicity. We may form a judgment of their intelligence level surprisingly rapidly. And these are the categories to which we have associations. They've gone by the name of stereotypes for a long time, ever since the 1920s when that term was introduced. These associations, some of them are ones we know exactly what we have. So, for example, in regard to old people, some of our associations are that they have poor memory. Some are that they are likely to be ill or infirm or slow. But even when we're not thinking about these things, they operate automatically and can influence our behavior. So when we first encounter a person whom we don't know, we probably apply these associations immediately and unthinkingly to the person, and until we learn otherwise, we are likely to assume that those things are true of that person.
What are the implications of having hidden biases?
There are many. We are concerned with some of the ones that affect us more, and the whole concept of the extent to which we live in a society that has a level playing field for all groups is very much intimately tied up with this. There are many people who are convinced that our society in America and in other countries also has achieved a point where there is full equal opportunity. Every American has the same opportunity to succeed. Well, the hidden biases we have actually don't allow that to be fully true. So demonstrating the extent to which that's true, the extent to which there are disadvantages that result from implicit or unconscious biases or hidden biases, is an important part of the research activity of Mahzarin Banaji, me, and numerous other social psychologists like us.
Would you explain the test you developed to detect hidden biases? What are the assumptions behind the test, and how does it work?
Well, first of all, the test is called the Implicit Association Test, or IAT for short. It was created at University of Washington in my laboratory in the mid-1990s. It was immediately apparent that this could potentially be important, and it's actually been picked up and used by many other scientists, not just social psychologists, but even people outside of psychology. But let me explain how it works. It's based on a very simple theoretical principle. It measures association strengths. Remember, the name of the test is Implicit Association Test, and the word implicit means that it gets an indirect measure that doesn't depend on the person knowing that he or she possesses the association that's being measured. So let me give an example, and this is actually the first one given in the book, and it's also the first one that existed when I first programmed this to run on a desktop computer in about 1994. It involves flowers, insects, pleasant words, and unpleasant words. The simple principle is that when two categories of things are associated in our minds, it's very easy to give the same response to members of those categories. So in the implicit association test that involves flowers and insects and pleasant and unpleasant words, the computer presents a series of names of flowers, insects, words that are pleasant, words that are unpleasant. If the instruction is to respond with one key to the flower names and the pleasant words, that turns out to be very easy, and the subjects in our experiments and the readers of our book who try this test will find that they do it fairly rapidly. If instead we change the instructions to give the same key response to unpleasant words and flower names, or we could ask to do it to insect names and pleasant words, this turns out to be difficult. It's done much more slowly, and the speed indicates the strength of association. So we infer from the typical response in this test that people have a stronger association of flower with pleasant than of insect with pleasant.
What is the evidence that the test actually measures hidden biases?
Well, this is what happened starting in the late 1990s after the test was introduced. Shortly after developing that one with flowers and insects, I produced the first race attitude test, which basically all it did was change the flower names and the insect names with names of famous African Americans and white or European Americans. And the task now was to give the same response to those names and pleasant or unpleasant words depending on the instructions. And it turned out that, and this was a shock to me when I demonstrated it first on myself, it turns out that I and many others are faster to give the same response to recognizably white American famous names and pleasant words than comparably famous and popular African American names and pleasant words. And this then became a measure that we later described as measuring automatic white preference, which means a preference for racial white relative to black. It doesn't necessarily mean disliking black. It measures a preference. And that was the first of the biases that could be said to be hidden, because this test result shows up in about 75% of Americans, which is a number hugely beyond what we consider to be the number of Americans who actually have overt prejudices, and in other words, are willing to say that they are not egalitarian and that they prefer white to black, or they could prefer black to white. The test also works to measure that.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Tony Greenwald, professor of psychology at the University of Washington and co-author with Mazarin Banaji of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. Is the implicit association test specific for certain cultures, or does it seem to be universally valid?
The results of the test will vary depending on the population, but a surprising number of the tests apply very widely. For example, one of the tests that produces a very strong result is showing that people more readily put pictures of old people more easily together with unpleasant words than pictures of young people, which can be more easily put together with pleasant words. And this automatic preference for young relative to old shows up in a fully 80% of people. Now, when we first got this result, we thought, well, gee, it would be interesting to test it in some East Asian societies that are known to have reverence for elders. And so we tried it in China and Japan, and somewhat shockingly, people in those societies have pretty much the same level of automatic preference for young relative to old. So that was a surprise, this sort of apparent cultural uniformity of the result, and we think that's likely to be obtained almost everywhere. That test has been operating in many countries. Listeners can go to the website implicit.harvard.edu to try about 14 or 15 tests that are available there, including the age one, the race one, and a few others. And the results we've obtained from visitors to this website from about 30 different countries in which it's operating show remarkable similarity in many things, but then there are others that vary from country to country. So Europeans, for example, have hidden biases that involve North Africans and Middle Easterners that are somewhat different from those had by Americans.
Let's go back now to the race implicit association test. Would you say more about to what extent the test correlates with conscious attitudes toward race?
This one has a small correlation, and I won't try to explain that in any statistical terms, but to give a sense, there are many people who describe themselves as fully egalitarian, and if you go to that implicit.harvard.edu site, you have a chance to answer some questions that ask you just to state what your attitudes are towards black and white. Many people who express absolute equality show the evidence for this bias. And I should say that these tests are also available to readers of the book. Some of them are actually in the book and can be done during the course of reading the book.
Why do you advise people to think twice about taking the race IIT test?
In the book, we do, after introducing the test, suggest that you may not want to take it if you're not willing to find out something that you don't expect about yourself, because fully 75% of the people who take that test, especially whites or Asians, to a little lesser extent Hispanics, will find out that the test gives them the automatic white preference result. So some people are not at all happy to find that out. In fact, one of the greatest concerns we have about using the test is that we need to find a way to get past the fact that some people react rather negatively to learning that they have in their head associations that they don't believe they have and that they don't want to have. And one of their reactions, and it's a very reasonable and natural one, is to assume that, well, the test must be no good at all. It's telling me I have something that I certainly can't have. In fact, that was, I would say, my first reaction to the test myself. But I quickly disabused myself of that reaction by conducting research and showing, yeah, there was actually evidence that I did have that association in my head.
In cases where there is an automatic preference for whites on the test, how does this relate to the person's behavior toward other races? To what extent do the biases actually predict behavior?
That was actually the most important question we recognized ever since the test was created, which was about 15 years ago. And it took about a decade for enough research to be done so that we were willing to conclude that there was an answer to this question. It was natural to assume that the test result might show something that was related to discriminatory behavior, but I didn't want to make that assumption, and I thought it was appropriate to be cautious until research evidence was in. And part of the reason for that is that what the test is measuring, which is the speed of classifying words and names or faces, is very different from what we mean by prejudice. So we've reached a pretty strong conclusion, two conclusions. One, that the test doesn't measure what we ordinarily think of as prejudice, which is sort of a hostile, discriminatory attitude towards outgroups, racial, ethnic, etc. But it measures a preference which in some cases is more like an in-group preference, which can show up as a willingness to do favors more or help more people who are like you and who are high on your list of automatic preferences. And the research has very clearly shown that the test does predict these kinds of behavior. Some of the tests are done in laboratory situations, but some have been done in employment hiring situations. So there have been quite a few studies done, enough to be combined into what scientists and statisticians call a meta-analysis, which is an overview of a collection of studies that have similar aims.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Tony Greenwald, professor of psychology at the University of Washington and co-author with Mazarin Banaji of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People. Would you give one or two examples of the hidden biases affecting behavior?
Yes. So I mentioned a study that had to do with hiring bias. So this was done by an economist in Sweden named Dan Olof Ruth and published in an economics journal, which is an unusual place for this kind of research to be published, but it is relevant to economics. And what he did was a study of a kind that's been done a number of times, which is to send resumes to businesses in response to job advertisements. And resumes were sent that were comparable in qualifications, but varied in whether the first name of the applicant was a Swedish first name, this was done in Sweden, or an Arab Muslim first name. And in Sweden, Muslims, Arab Muslims, are a target of discrimination. This is well recognized and it's considered something of a problem. It turned out, not surprisingly, that, and this kind of hiring audit has been done in many other locations, including the United States, that the Swedish first-named applicants were more likely to be called in for job interviews. But what Roof did, this is the economist who did the study, next was quite remarkable. He waited about 6 months after these hiring managers had made these decisions. Then he recontacted them and arranged for them to take a version of the IAT online that measured their classification of Swedish and Arab Muslim names together with pleasant and unpleasant words. In other words, it was a measure of automatic Swedish preference done in Sweden. And then he correlated that with the records he had of how these same hiring managers had responded to the resumes earlier and found a correlation. So this was an example which showed that this Swedish Muslim IAT result had a prediction of the discrimination shown by the hiring managers. Now, it was not a huge correlation, These are modest correlations. For those who are familiar with correlation numbers, they're correlations on the order of 0.20 or 0.30, where 1.0 is the maximum value for a correlation. And while this is understood to be a moderate correlation, it's actually a correlation that when it applies to behavior that occurs many times or is applied to many people, has huge impact and really discriminatory impact. So excuse me for that long example, but I hope it makes clear how the IAT can be and had been used in research. And we've also done studies, which I won't go into now, on voting behavior in an election that involves an African-American candidate against a white American candidate.
How do the hidden biases come to be? What are the underlying causes?
We don't fully know the answer to that question. So when you ask me that question, I will tell you that I'm giving you my best guess, because it's really very difficult to do research that would establish this. But we know that they develop early because we now have versions of the implicit association test that can be used with quite young children down to age 5 or so. And we think that they probably don't come directly from one's parents, but more maybe from one's peers, and probably even more importantly, from the media exposures we have. And this particularly applies to what we see in children. Actually, the studies with children have focused more on stereotypes related to gender than race, even though race is also being used. So we think gender stereotypes form rather early.
What are the best ways to get rid of hidden biases that you would rather not have?
One would hope that there was some easy method for exterminating hidden biases. And a number of my colleagues, social psychologists, have done research in which they've tested various techniques. The good news is that these techniques work, that hidden biases can be reduced. The bad news is that the evidence we have so far is that they work for a period of minutes or perhaps hours. We have very little evidence that methods of reducing hidden biases are durable. But this is actually a work in progress. This is difficult research to do to demonstrate that these things can work. But at the moment, we're not really optimistic about changing hidden biases by training techniques, in part because any training techniques that we might use will be opposed by re-encounter with the cultural environment that contains the experiences that tend to establish the associations that are measured by the IAT.
Are there ways of getting around the hidden biases in terms of behavior?
Well, this is what we end up recommending in the book. So the last chapter of the book, which we call Outsmarting the Machine, talks about, and in this case, the machine is our own brains, which operate partly without our being able to know exactly how they're operating and without our being aware of it. We talk about ways to do things that prevent the operation of the biases or just minimize their opportunity to occur. So if you are, for example, someone who's making a hiring decision, do things to try to evaluate the candidates as objectively as possible. Use criteria that are valid, that predict their performance, instead of going on a subjective impression of the person that would be based on looking at a resume and just saying, oh, do I like this person or not? That kind of called discretion in making judgments seems to be a doorway through which hidden biases have a chance to operate. So trying to be as objective as possible in decisions. In other words, to apply thought rather than to go on the basis of gut feelings. This is probably the best way to do it. We do give an example in the book of a very simple mechanism that worked to defeat a hidden bias, which is the history of use of musical auditions for symphony orchestras behind screens so that the audition committee couldn't tell whether the performer was male or female. Turned out as soon as that was adopted, and it was adopted in many orchestras about 20 years ago, the number of women hired in orchestras jumped from about 20% to 40% over a relatively short period.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Oh, buy the book. Well, obviously, that's one message, but let me go back to maybe where I started, which was talking about this revolution that's going on in psychology. I think the most valuable takeaway from the book is some insight into what psychologists, not just social psychologists, but cognitive psychologists, developmental psychologists, clinical psychologists, are discovering, which is the extent to which our behavior is under the control of associations and other processes that we don't have full awareness of or introspection of. And understanding this is quite important. This is, in a way, a return to an emphasis on unconscious process that some people may know of from Freudian psychoanalytic theory, which was in its flowering quite a while ago and fell out of favor among academic psychologists, but is now returned and is returned to psychology in ways that are much more amenable to empirical research. And that's really what this revolution, this implicit revolution that I'm talking about, is doing. It is bringing reliable, reproducible research methods to this topic of unconscious mental process that's been fascinating for so long.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Tony.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks for being interested.
You are just listening to Anthony Greenwald, professor of psychology at the University of Washington and co-author with Mazarin Banaji of the book Blind Spot, Hidden Biases of Good People, published in 2013 by Delacourt Press. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.